It's good that it's not really packed up here, because I'm sorry to be taking you with fish for the last month. I swear to God, this is the last time we're going to read the catfish only. I finally got to the end of this one. It's different from last week. Just a note before I read, New Madrid, you know, in the dairy we like to take the names of European cities and bastardize them to make them sound more normal to us. So Madrid turns into Madrid. And there's a fault line that runs down the Mississippi River called the New Madrid Fault. And a couple hundred years ago, there was such a huge earthquake that the Mississippi River actually reversed course and went backwards. So it talks about that a little bit. And another thing is that because the river is between two states' jurisdictions, you can actually gamble on a boat on the river, and that's become a big industry in my city, riverboat gambling, because it's not illegal if it's not on land. But the poem is called Catfish. Catfish are souls in limbo, slogging through the clogged veins of the Mississippi, unlike that venerable Saint Salmon, which knits wisdom and muscles against the clear stream. Catfish are taken by line, or a fist for Friday sacraments, around this gateway city where people settled on settling, having paused at the green rest of the west and turned inward again. In the catfish heavens, neon stretch marks span the water's surface as citizens walk through the eye of a loophole to riverboat casinos praying for a fiscal blessing. All souls have forgotten that fault below, that restless spine of New Madrid, which only 200 years ago, upstream, downstream, reversing everything, making fish of human bodies, and leaving catfish in wonder, gasping on the banks. Thanks.
Next up we have Joe Sweeney.
Hello, I'm going to read another little excerpt from a very long ghost story that I'm telling. It's called Aunt Emily's Secret, and it's about two boys who've lost both their parents and are going to live with their Aunt Emily on the train. Another vague memory comes back to me. It is of the funeral. It comes into my mind like a mist approaching, swirling around me, taking me into itself. I'm standing on the steps of the church. The neighbors who arranged it all, namely Mrs. Gosling, come up, sorry for our trouble, shake our hands, then go off whispering to each other in small groups. I look at them and overhear what they're saying. What's going to happen to the children now? Who's going to take care of them? Are there really no other relatives? I thought they had an aunt in England, Aunt Emily or something. It's very sad. It's really very sad. We are driven home in a long black car and stop inside number 12. I can see children from the other houses pointing. I can only imagine what they're saying. Lock. Here's the four of them boys now. We're no longer Darren or Jason. It's like we've been welded together. We're the four of them boys now. I hate this enforced brotherliness. I hate being viewed by everyone as inseparable from my little brother. I've always been independent, always wanted to be free to go my own way, have my own life, and that doesn't seem possible now. We're now the tragic mirror. We can't be helped. Nothing can be helped. All the neighborhood friends gather round to look at us. They seem to have forgotten that we are the same as we've always been. It's they who have changed, but try telling that to the sympathizers. They're on a roll, and if you get in their way, they'll run over you. We just have to play our parts in the whole thing, I suppose, and accept their pity. Even old Mr. Clark was looking sympathetically at us. He seemed to have forgotten all about us robbing his apples. I remember one of the women down the road said to Darren and me once, You boys are certainly not the apples of Mr. Clark's eye, that's for sure. We told Mom and Dad and they laughed at that. Badger Clark was at the funeral too. Lucky as if he wouldn't know what an apple was if you hit him over the head with a barrel of them. He seems to have suddenly forgiven us for all those times we broke in and really gave him apoplexy. And I have to say, the hardest thing of all, the thing that came to a real shock, was when I first heard some people talking at the funeral, and they referred to myself and Darren as orphans. That word got into me, I can tell you, what a horrible word and a horrible thing. I've been thinking of it a lot recently. Chapter 2 of the train journey. Half an hour of the train now, Broombridge, Ashtown, Castleknock, Leeds, Slip, Moose. I look out the window so as not to have to look at Darren crying all the time or even think of him. Sometimes I wish Darren wasn't there. That's no help, bad at all as he is. It would be worse to be alone. Suddenly I'm aware of myself standing and shouting angrily. I'm not going to sit opposite a crybaby for the entire journey, you know. He looks at me startled. Darren, I shout, just put it all out of your mind. You've been crying since we left the house. I can't take it anymore. All right, he says. He almost looks afraid of me. None of this crying is going to bring Mom and Dad back, no, Darren. I know, he sniffs. It's not that. They wouldn't want us to be around crying all the time. They would want us to get on with life, Darren. Darren glances at me. It is a brief, sidelong glance. A strange one before he looks out the window again. We become silent and I start thinking of Dad and Mom again. They were always so full of life, so active, maybe a bit too active. I try to remember if they were driving too fast when the accident happened. I say accident, but really I wonder if there are any real accidents. Oh, it's no use, I can't remember, but I feel sure it was mainly that lorry driver to blame. He was over the line, even in the rain. I'm beginning to feel a bit better now that Darren has stopped crying. The train lurches into Kilcock Station and is going to stop, and it brings back another flashback of the accident. It only lasts a brief time, but it is horrifying. Darren has blood on his face, a single red streak trickling down, strangely straight, like the red line of a thermometer descending. The hair on the crown of his head is a wet black tangle, concealing the gash somewhere beneath. A minor one, but somehow in the shocked and strange atmosphere of the car after the collision, my eyes keep focusing on it. I blink a few times until the terrible sight disappears again. I gasp and open my eyes and I'm relieved to see Darren again sitting opposite me in the train, still, with only dry streaks of tears and not blood down his cheeks. I shake my head to clear my mind, sit back, watch the grey town of Kilcock drop back, the green fields come on with a rush. I remind myself that we are lucky to be alive, but I don't feel so lucky right now, of course. Maybe by the end of the day, we will be with Aunt Emily and everything will be better. After the city, the country will be a nice change. Mom always loved the country. A complete change is just what we need, she would say, trying to encourage all of us. I certainly think we're ready for a complete change now. I just wonder what Aunt Emily will be like.
Next up, we have James Harrington.
The word is he's back in Glen Tower. They'll coax him tonight in the bar. Relate that tall tale when you hoist a sail to fight for your uncle the Tsar. The sweetest old man in Uras, whose weakness involved candy floss, he rushed to the stall, by total recall, my dentist advised me to floss. Terence Caterpillar has reminded me of this one, so I dug out this called cutbacks. But in Mushroom, we can't withdraw the course. It's expected, and enrollments are up. They've got a foot in the door. It's on the prospectus, subject to demand. A run on cast materials? Rubbish. We'll be sued without a leg to stand on. Hand clapping and footstool step-ups and plimsolls were good enough once. Now we must put them all through their paces. We know the new floor permits only soft soles. There's a footnote here about that. But think of the cost if you were a parent of centipede twins. Who'd foot the bill? The board chairman will hear about this, I say. He's a weekly pedicure, well known for his stance on PE and ability to think on his feet. Herbivore, his wife, is a podiatrist, chief observer for the three-legged race and founding chair of the Alumni Association of Millipedes. Cold call. Your precious time for a moment or two. Your service provider is currently who? Our latest rendition, because of attrition, we're in a position to offer 3 minutes and modems to you, and channels as clear as a didgeridoo. All stations. The forecast now is storm force 10. Our moorings will be tested soon. We'll hear it shrieking down the glen. You'll surely take your bearings when the forecast is for storm force 10. The ebb will start at stroke of noon. The forecast is a storm force 10. Each mooring will be tested soon. Mobile dog wash. It's just across the roads of deadly spinning wheels, where every puppy shows the cleanest pair of heels. Pegasus. Parts merge to enchant, then Zeus, he is gone in one lightning bolt, blowtorched sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I'll return to spot stars on his flanks, hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. Thank you.
Next up, we have Alan Coakley. It's been lovely weather, really, since that point. And it's called the summer point. So the press is called Summer Running. Fresh air refusing. Summer in her orgasmic elegance giving. The metronomic percussion at my feet is almost music. And the second one is Summer Rain. The rain came in mid-May, softening up the summer like a free orgasmic lover. The sun's rays stretch long and far and soak the soul. Chasing light is like chasing sun. No need to chase, stand still. And the rain is a deep breath blessing, like sadness, before the bliss of summer. And Donna Stretti.
Thanks very much, Alan. Next up, we have Helmer Kavanagh-Rowland. The darkness meets the light. My designer bag is arranged, ready, yet I have nothing to wear. The DNA accoutrements are aligned to the plan, yet I cannot tell, a woman or a man. A tabula errata is my mind, but how do I know this? Waiting for my orders, hoping for information. Yet I'm understanding totally the impending situation. My essence is an issue with the designer. My components are in order, but my ocular focus on one soul is quite battling on the whole. Am I to be free at last to battle with nature against my nurture? Abide by that old human adage, or will I be trapped forever in this designer package? My appropriatism is an issue. Handies, fingers, knees and nose, all correctly affected. They understand, they recognize, and with oozed eyes, I am accepted. By those who cannot see, what drives the eye to steal a learning before you are born, and reveal it only to those who know, that light of ancient form, the flickering quakerism of the firstborn, the light who knew the darkness.
Next up we have Miriam Casey.
Thalia. She entered the room and looked for him within the smoky fragrance. Instantly she felt a light tap on her arm and she turned around in horror. Mademoiselle, he bowed to her and her colour rose. She knew that he had guessed her secret. As his fingers caressed, the eyes stared straight into hers and told her so. She felt a giddiness of power as she lowered her eyes. She felt herself being led to the dance floor. As he guided her on the floor, she heard him whisper, "What do you wish for, Tanya?" She answered, "I want to be like you, Jack." Rudely, he answered, "You wish to be a man." Angrily, she replied, "No, you know it is not that." She felt a finger caress her neck. He gave a low laugh which made her shiver. She started and went to leave him, but he prevented her by stronger pressure on her arm and a soft statement, "Young lady love, we shall see." That night she lay in her bed expecting him. She tossed and turned, sensitive to every little cry of the wind. Anticipation and fear kept her awake. Would he be a bat or a wolf? How was he going to initiate her? But as she cried out his name, Jacques, all she felt was the same pressure on her arm, the pressure he had used on the floor during the dance. The morning came and the sun had risen. Crying to herself, she went to the bathroom to wash. When she looked into the mirror and saw that she looked very pale. It was as if all her colour had drained and she felt joy. It was beginning. Soon she would be like Jacques. Rejoicing, she began to sing the song "Fair Jacques" and got herself ready for work. As she felt the pressure on her arm, she instinctively knew that at the next party, Jacques would complete. She would be with him forever. All day, every love song that she heard intoxicated her. Jack, Jack, tall, masculine, sensual, mysterious Jack, only 2 nights away and she would be his. Adrienne, her best friend, asked her about her sudden high spirit. She only hugged her friend and said that she was just looking forward to the party, and that was all. The day of the party arrived, and when the old grandfather clock began to strike 8, Dahlia began to dress. She put on the creamy skirt and the soft embroidered blouse. She was going as a gypsy. It would please him, she was sure. And as she sprinkled her favourite perfume, she could hear in the breeze Thalia, and she knew that he was waiting. When she reached the house, it was crowded. So many people, but no Jacques. All night she sat with a glass of wine in her hand, waiting for him to appear, but no Jacques. Going home, she made the taxi stop halfway, and in a state of ecstasy and fear, she began to walk the rest of the way home. She was just past the neighbourhood park. All was dark and quiet. The light from the lamp seemed to beam up messages to the carpet of stars above when he appeared. "Jack," she whispered and ran towards him. Immediately, he raised his hand and asked her, "Thalia, you are sure about this?" Tears flooded her eyes. She nodded, and with a terse nod of his head, they appeared in the shadows, vampires all. And they began to form a ring, and Jack and herself were enclosed within it. She began to see herself immersed in a possession, and she saw Jack look at her and look at his ring. She stared into his face as his teeth began to grow longer, and his hand grabbed her by the hair. He no longer looked seductive. There was a breeze before her, howling that she was his, and as she cried for help from Providence, she heard herself sing "Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star." When his teeth entered her neck, she cried, half to him, half to herself, "Have I become?" The blood began to fall on her clothes. She felt incorrect. As a soft voice answered, "No, child, you are dying, but you are not one of us." Tanya smiled, and with her dying breath, she placed her hand upon his ring. The stars twinkled. In pain, Jack seemed.
Thanks very much, Ryan. So next up, we have a song from John Wagner.
This is a song called Green Fields Have Turned Brown. Beware the Irish bandit, it is far too sentimental. The imagery it peddles is not one bit transcendental. They'll fleet around like angels when you're lost in a foreign town. But they will never tell you how the green fields have turned brown. Kathleen's pure green mantle has been auctioned for a fee. Nothing warms the Irish heart like a wad of dirty money. And all that's fine and green they'll willingly tear down, and they'll just call it progress. How the green fields have turned brown. And they'll support the rich while wringing money from the poor. For the lost heifer stranded in an open moral sewer. Oh, they don't see the state they're in as they're hypnotized by clowns. Drunk on their sense of power, they have turned the green fields brown. Oh, I can't take you home, Kathleen, for I think you a disgrace. You filthy scars and lesions on your once pretty face. Perhaps it's not your fault, but I will walk with you no more. Down the old bog road, you're a swindler and a whore. So I'll ask you this question, it's the one time I will ask. Is this self-harm a symptom of shame at Ireland's past? Strangers to prosperity, we were kicked, we were held down. To escape the aching nightmare, we have turned the green fields brown. To escape the aching nightmares, we have turned the green fields brown. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jen. This is called Cherry Blossom, and it's kind of about telling someone something and they just won't accept it, and there's not much you can do about it. You lie, carving deeper into walls with this around yourself, hands flat on ceiling. You complain about absence of air. I try to send you cherry blossoms. Futures furled like infant's twisted hands, yours for the opening. Still, you refuse to grow up, to move from the cock room to small fields, to take baby steps out onto worlds and outside. There's no space for us both in this rusted old womb, and this I have told you times a thousand and one, till your lips won't formulate acceptance. I hope you find cherry blossoms. I have lent faith from car windows to catch their cherry rain kisses, as I have followed the road with these trees as true landmarks. I must fight the wind that fledges them forward, only hope that it will carry me further with them, take the branch proper like a hand in a storm, and inhale their breath deeply. And though I am since long gone, I hope you find cherry blossoms, blooming within the cavities of walls, staining with colour the snow at the edges, spilling through windows and door frames. May they carry you over new thresholds, may your steps be light with their spring. We have Eugene Crowley.
Dawn, Havana, Foster Bay, by Bosco, by Lorilos, people of Cuba, Tatus, Cortes, Gorgeous.
Thanks very much, Eugene. Could we have General Tappan in here?
This is something I wrote maybe about 15 minutes ago, before I came here, based on the memory of something else I'd written, which I forgot, and it's on a bit of brown paper because that's what I had, but it's entitled Madness, and it's based on a first, second and third hand experience. That kind of thing. So, madness. The man of reason communicates only through the abstract means of disease, and the madman communicates only through moral and physical constraint. There is no common language. My friend, I am well pleased that you suffer this malady. You have received great grace from our Lord, who determined that you should suffer from thy iniquities in this world. The true reality of life, the madman's laugh, the laugh of fear disarms it. Fear, nothingness. Madness is closer to reason than reason itself. The madman embarks on a different wind in a ship of fools, and disembarks on a different shore in search of reason. No enigma is concealed. Madness is the punishment of a disorderly and presumptuous science. The madness of the artist and the poet. Rich, he is poor. Poor, he is rich. Ugly, and he admires himself. Madness is the result in the dimension of error. An illusion of death found only by death. Merely life more disturbed than a life more disturbing.